Major funding for Backstory is provided by an anonymous donor, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the Robert and Joseph Cornell Memorial Foundation.
From Virginia Humanities, this is Backstory. Welcome to Backstory, the show that explains the history behind today's headlines. I'm Nathan Connolly.
I'm Joanne Freeman.
And I'm Ed Ayers.
If you're new to the podcast, we're historians, and each week, along with our co-host Brian Ballow, we explore the history of a topic that's been in the news.
Normally, this is when we take you back to a moment in history. But this week, we're talking about something that's happening right now. On May 4th, the brand new American Civil War Museum in Richmond, Virginia, opens to the public. Now, for full disclosure, I should add that I'm the founding chairman of the museum's board.
A merger of several historic sites, including the former Museum of the Confederacy, the American Civil War Museum is hoping to present a new narrative of the conflict that's diverse, inclusive, and balanced.
This painting is known as The Last Meeting of Lee and Jackson.
That's Kathy Wright. She's a curator at the American Civil War Museum and a former curator at the Museum of the Confederacy. She spoke to Backstory producer Melissa Gismondi at the museum.
What we're seeing are Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson, two of the most revered Confederate military commanders, on horseback, meeting before the Battle of Chancellorsville. And this is the battle in which Jackson would be mortally wounded. Prints of this painting were made and were owned by many white Southerners in the post-war period. So this is a very recognizable image to many people.
Kathy says the painting, which is 12 feet high and 8 feet wide, is one of the largest items in the museum's collection, which can make it hard to curate.
It sort of dominates the space, and we wanted to provide some balance to that.
The museum aimed to do that by displaying the painting alongside texts of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments to the Constitution. They also chose to display it alongside a carefully curated image.
On the wall immediately facing the painting is a very large colorized photograph of African-American legislators from Virginia in the 1870s. These men are shown at larger than life size. It's a group of 8 men, and it's really striking to see that photo in color at that scale, and I think really helps to bring together a lot of the themes which we're trying to cover in this space.
You'll hear more from Melissa's tour of the museum's exhibits with Kathy later in the show.
Although the Civil War ended more than 150 years ago, its iconography, history, and message are invoked almost daily. And events like the 2015 massacre at the historic Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston and the 2017 Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville have sparked a debate about how the war should be represented in public spaces.
So, on this episode, we're giving you an exclusive, behind-the-scenes look at the American Civil War Museum in Richmond. We'll bring you a feature conversation I had with Christy Coleman, the museum's director. Now, she's no stranger to controversy, and she believes that museums have the power to change the world.
And we look at the gift shop and ask, how does the museum negotiate the politics of Civil War memorabilia?
Christy Coleman is one of the most extraordinary museum curators in the country. As an African-American woman tasked with creating a new museum of the Civil War, she needed vision and diplomatic skills aplenty. And she told me she had a very early, very visceral immersion in Southern history.
At Colonial Williamsburg.
This is at Colonial Williamsburg, right? Yeah, as a summer job, as a character interpreter is what they were called.
Yeah.
And it was portraying a person of the past. Her name was Rebecca. She was an enslaved young woman about my age. I mean, they had to find somebody for me. And she was the property of John Blair. And the premise behind her story was that he was sick and dying, and it was creating anxiety because young Rebecca didn't know what was going to happen to her if he died.
Wow, that's pretty heavy debut as an acting role, huh?
It was. So I did those summers, went away, worked at another museum, came back to Colonial Williamsburg, and eventually became director of African American Interpretations and Presentations. And one of the first actions in that role was the decision to reenact an estate sale, which included the sale of slaves.
Wow.
And that's the first time I was thrust into the public and the public relations and media spotlight. You know, Colonial Williamsburg decided that I should be the face of this thing.
Now, it was very controversial at the outset, but it seemed that in some ways you brought people along to understand why this would be a helpful scene.
Absolutely. I mean, it was an extraordinarily important moment. Even though there was so much anxiety going into it, lots of controversy, people felt this isn't appropriate to do in a museum setting, a particular at Colonial Williamsburg or whatever. But what it did in the post days of that is that I received letters from academics around the nation, around the world, really. Other museum colleagues, particularly those at historic houses and plantation sites, contacted me and said, if they can do that, we at least need to have an honest conversation about the enslaved populations at our sites. And so that began what I think was sort of the birth of us finally knowing the stories about Hemings and the other 300-plus people that were at Monticello and learning about the 300-plus people that were in Mount Vernon and so forth and so on. I mean, that was the moment.
When was that moment?
1994,
yeah.
Which is ridiculous, right? You know, 25 years ago. But that was the moment.
There aren't many topics in American history that are still as contentious as the Civil War. So what were the issues that Christie and her staff faced creating this new institution?
We had to completely reimagine the meaning of the war. We had to start there. And then from that, it's like, okay, well, if you're imagining the meaning of it, why it matters in contemporary life, then that means you really have to examine it the way that people lived it. So we started saying, okay, well, how did they live it? And then it was like, well, they lived in constant chaos. There was always changing choices. There was never knowing what was going to happen around the next corner. There was this period for some of, is this my moment? Is freedom coming? For others, there was just the basic question of where should my allegiance lie? And we also quickly realized that this conflict impacted Native nations. While it wasn't a global crisis, it had global impact.
Certainly.
Because of the trades. We acknowledge that if we're thinking about this as constant chaos and death and destruction at a scale that had never been seen before, that you're also dealing with trauma. It is a high emotion thing. So how do you tell that story in an impactful way? And so it meant to me that it could no longer be a story that was just fixated on the military or the political. It had to intertwine, again, the way that people lived it. And so that meant there was this constant flow of impact. Something that's happening in the society is going to affect a military action. Something that the politicians do is going to end up impacting what happens on the battlefield. And what the community is railing against or rallying for is going to impact political action. So all of these factors are constantly in play. And people are changing their minds constantly about their support for the war or its aims and so forth. So creating that kind of fractious environment actually became sort of a visual vernacular for us.
So in many ways, what you're trying to do is tell the story both on a global and a personal scale
mm-hmm,
at the
mm-hmm.
same time. It's not that we're not telling the stories of military history and political history, but we're weaving them together into the stories of abandonment and of death on a battlefield and of homesickness and of political conflict, right? So how is a museum the place that that story can be told in a way it can't be told anywhere else?
Well, every time Pew Research Center does a study on trusted institutions, museums always rank number two behind libraries, which means that's a tremendous amount of power and importance to help communities navigate.
Yeah.
And I tell people all the time, history has never, ever been for the dead. It is about our lived experience. It is about our environment. And so museums have the capacity through its collections, through its storytelling strength, to help people make sense of the past and make that usable. And because we use a variety of learning techniques, whether it is, you know, the text on the wall that can never be too much, whether it's the visual image that has an emotional impact, whether it is the artifact, there's something about the real thing that people really relate to. And we have a ton of the real thing, you know, that when they see it, it brings even more truth. And I think that those sort of that center, that vision, that understanding is what helps us be successful and has enabled us to really re-examine every single program and event that we've done through that lens.
So what's this new building like? What were its priorities?
Well, you know, the priority certainly was be mindful of the historic fabric of the site. There are original buildings here, and there are industrial artifacts buried in the ground. I mean, we have tunnels and canals and all kinds of things that dot this 9-acre site.
Yeah, this is one of the largest industrial sites in the United States at the time.
And we were also concerned what we would find when we started digging.
So you've invested so much in this for so long.
Yeah.
You're waiting just days until the world shows up.
Yep.
What do you want them to take away from this experience?
I want them to be awed and inspired. This thing is beautiful. It's beautiful. It's impactful. From the moment you walk through the doors of the new building, you know you're in someplace different because immediately you see the honoring of the past, because we built this building around a ruin of the original foundry here.
So what if you're a relatively recent arrival to America? You don't really feel any investment in this story. Why in the world would you come to the American Civil War Museum?
Because as soon as you walk through the door, not only would you potentially see people of your ancestral ethnic group, but you would also immediately begin to understand just how much this particular conflict and its aftermath impacts American life. You will begin to recognize, whether it's ideologies, whether it is the way sort of American culture, particularly political and social culture, evolves, you will see it. It'll be very apparent to you. Anyone that wants to understand America and who and what she is will get a glimpse of that because of this conflict. And let's not forget, I mean, the American Civil War was an attempt at a birth of a new freedom. But it is the saving of a republic. It is the saving of an idea. And that, I think, is inescapable.
I was talking with Christy Coleman, the Chief Executive Officer of the American Civil War Museum in Richmond, which opens its doors to the public this week.
As Christy said there, the new museum drew on the collections of two previous institutions. So the selection of artifacts and the context they were put in was a vital part of telling the story. Curator Kathy Wright showed backstory producer Melissa Gismondi around the exhibition, some of which was still being unpacked, as you may hear.
So you were saying we're standing in the main gallery.
Yeah, we've just entered the main gallery, and we're standing in what's essentially the beginning of the war. So this particular area really is trying to get visitors a sense of the creation of the Confederacy and both the United States and the Confederacy ramping up for war and the first battles of the war. So we have a large artifact display case on one side that explores real people and decisions that they made about which side to support and how they did that. So we've really tried to choose people who are both for the Union and for the Confederacy and the way that the outbreak of war really impacted their lives. So, for instance, we have a Southern woman and a Northern man who were engaged in 1860, and the outbreak of war prevented them getting married for a number of years. She eventually takes a boat of truce and travels up to New York City during the war and is finally able to marry him. But it took several years to coordinate that.
Do we know, was it kind of a torturous decision for both of them?
It was a difficult decision in that they seemed to have been very much in love and they wanted to get married, and she wanted her family to be present. So she was from Virginia, and they wrote letters to each other back and forth, which then had to be delivered through a boat of truce. And she finally made the decision and was able to leave from Norfolk, Virginia, with her mother and travel up to New York in 1863, and that's when they were finally married. So we have a large portrait of her, and we're going to exhibit some reproductions of the letters as well as their marriage certificate.
Is their story one that's new to the museum, or if I had been, say, at the Museum of the Confederacy, would I have heard their story there too?
You would not have heard their story before. We had her portrait on display in what was essentially a meeting room, which was only used for various public meetings and programs and things of that sort, but there was no real explanation of who she was or their lengthy, drawn-out romance and separation. So we're looking at the second of the media pieces, which is going to be presented to visitors. This is another approximately 3-minute long audio and video presentation. And what we really wanted to show within this space is the way that African Americans had been sort of taking their own steps, even before the war began, to free themselves, and the way that sort of the evolution of emancipation and things like the Emancipation Proclamation influenced their decision about whether to flee to Union lines or whether to stay where they were. So we've selected a number of stories and quotations from real people to highlight the variety of decisions that people made. We start out with a story that was told by a former slave of a young African-American girl being punished and then sold.
Once Mrs. was sick, and a slave girl named Alice brought her some water and something to eat. Mrs. got sick to her stomach, and she said Alice was trying to poison her. She got out of bed, strips that gal to her waist, and whips her with a cowhide. Alice was chained down by the arms and legs until she got well. Then she was carried off to Richmond in chains and sold.
So we start out with sort of the worst things which could have happened to a slave. And then we move forward into the story of a man who chose to run away. He was in Louisiana. He hid in the swamps from slave hunters for several months, and finally made it to Union lines where he enlisted as a Union soldier and served for the duration of the war.
One morning the bell was rung for us to go to work so early that I could not see, and I lay still. For this, the overseer was going to have me whipped. I ran away to the woods, where I remained for a year and a half. Are they after me? Can I stay free? What's going to happen to my family? I had to steal my food, took turkeys, chicken, and pigs. We slept on logs and burned cypress leaves to make a smoke and keep away mosquitoes. Eugene Jardot, master of hounds, hunted us for 3 months. One day, 20 hounds came after me. We killed 8. The dogs followed us into the bayou, and the alligators caught 6 of them. We escaped to Union lines, where I joined Company C, 15th Regiment, Corps d'Afrique.
And we conclude with a quotation from a letter that was written by an African-American woman in Maryland, which was not, which had slaves, but as part of the Union, they were not freed as a result of the Emancipation Proclamation. So she wrote a letter to Abraham Lincoln.
Mr. President, it is my desire to be free, to go to see my people, you will please let me know if we are free?
There's no record of any response to her letter, and she's writing during the war, so we know that the answer to that was that no, she was not free, and therefore had to wait for the 13th Amendment to be passed in 1865.
Do we know what happened to that woman in the years after the war?
We do not know what happened to her.
Is that story, so for, you know, now I'm thinking about what this media installation, and it's also next to, there's a giant colorized photo of two enslaved people picking cotton in a field. How is this different from how the issue of slavery would have been represented at the Museum of the Confederacy?
One of the things which we really wanted to do in this new exhibition, which we'd not have the opportunity to do before, was to focus on the African-American experience throughout the exhibition and to really incorporate it and weave it throughout the overall narrative in a way that I think most other exhibitions, including our own previously, will talk about African-Americans almost as a sideline. And you'll get occasional little mentions of them, but they're not the main characters. We wanted to make them one of the main characters and put their story and the story of the evolution of emancipation throughout the war at the core of all of this. We have lots of flags in our collection, and this is one of my favorites because of the story behind it. And I think a lot of people, when they see a Confederate flag, they have really strong feelings one way or another about it. But this one, I think, challenges a lot of those preconceptions. It is just a standard Army of Northern Virginia battle flag, so it's that very recognizable, red background with white stars on a blue cross. This particular flag was carried, we think, based on research, by the 49th North Carolina Infantry, and it was carried during the Petersburg Campaign, which was in Petersburg, Virginia, in 1864, at the Battle of the Crater. Now, this is famously where Union and Confederate troops had sort of been in a standoff in siege warfare, and Union troops had hit upon a plan to dig a tunnel underneath the Confederate line of fortifications and to detonate a large amount of black powder, basically blow a hole in the Confederate lines and then send in Union troops. So this happened, I think it was July 30th, 1864, when this is finally detonated, and the resulting crater became known as the Battle of the Crater, and African-American U.S. colored troops were the first ones sent in, and this really became just a complete scene of chaos and destruction for both sides. You had Confederate soldiers who were trapped in a lot of the dirt and the various debris from the explosion. You had now Union troops that are going into that, and a lot of really fierce hand-to-hand combat. The flag of the 49th North Carolina was captured by U.S. colored troops in this battle. Capturing a flag was an enormous honor for any soldier. So as far as I know, this is the only flag that is recorded as being captured by the U.S. colored troops. The U.S. Army kept very careful records of who captured a flag because they were eligible for a Medal of Honor. So this particular flag, we have had conserved, and we're really very excited to be able to put it on display and present it with the history of its association with the crater and with the colored troops. It's an artifact that really bridges both sides of the story and sort of shows how the military situation had changed so dramatically by 1864 that you have black men in uniform who are able to go in and perform actions that make them eligible to receive medals of honor.
Was this flag on display at the Museum of the Confederacy?
It was on display, but it was kind of in a downstairs gallery that wasn't part of a cohesive exhibition. It was just sort of a standalone item, but it was one that we'd been really excited to get conserved, and now I'm really pleased to see it more integrated and interwoven into the overall story of the war. one of the challenges with any exhibition on the Civil War is you have to get the war started and you also have to end it. So the very final gallery of the exhibition focuses on the post-war period. And we're not defining this and limiting it with any particular year, but we do want to anchor the space with the three amendments to the U.S. Constitution, which immediately followed the war. So these were tremendous steps forward in the United States and are all amendments which continue to be discussed and debated and relevant today as we talk about things like voting rights and citizenship. As these rights were given to African Americans, there were also a lot of white supremacists who were looking for ways to reassert their authority. And this is an aspect that we also want to not lose sight of as we talk about some of the progress that was made. There's also this pushback. So we do talk about some terror organizations, such as the Ku Klux Klan, which were established to reassert control by instilling fear in African Americans, as well as more legal and political means which were put forth to discourage African Americans from voting. So things like the poll tax, which was soon adopted in many states, that basically made it financially impossible for the average, you know, poor person, white or black, to go to the polls.
How do you illustrate that with items? What sorts of items will be on display in that?
We're going to be exhibiting a poll tax receipt. Anyone who paid a poll tax was given a receipt. So we have a reproduction of one of those, which will be used to help talk about voting rights. A document that we're using to illustrate African-American civil rights is a marriage certificate. The ability for black couples to be able to formally get married and have a legally recognized partnership was hugely important to many people. So the marriage certificate, which we're exhibiting, was issued to a couple who had already been together as a couple for, I think, about 12 years. They had several children together, and they were enormously excited to be able to formally get married and have this document, which named them as man and wife. Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, you talked about there's this official war ends, but the violence doesn't stop for many African Americans. So how is, you know, your job as a curator, how do you convey that in a way where it sounds like it's a delicate balance? You need to recognize the progress that's made, but then as a curator also address the fact that in some cases, in some towns, African Americans are still in danger in many cases.
It's challenging to sort of personally and professionally to realize that in many ways some of the lessons of the war still haven't been learned today, and that we're still dealing with some of this. My hope for history and the study of history and coming to museums is that in learning about the past, that we can hope to learn from it and make better choices in the future and not go back and repeat past mistakes. I hope that it teaches people to be more careful thinkers, not only about things that happened in the past, but in looking at issues today. Very upsetting, you know, just to see in the news in the past week or so that, you know, there are still black churches being targeted and burned. So clearly there are still lessons which we haven't learned collectively. Mm-hmm. But I hope that we can see the humanity in people and that the enormous struggles that people have made in the past, particularly African Americans, so many of them coming from slavery and having almost nothing and giving up in many cases what very little that they had in order to become free for themselves, for their children, that this still encourages us to continue to struggle and fight for what is right today.
That's Kathy Wright, curator at the American Civil War Museum. To see images of some of the items Kathy discussed, head to our website, backstoryradio.org.
In 2015, the National Park Service issued a statement asking shops at its sites across the nation to stop selling the Confederate battle flag. The decision came in the weeks after the shooting of 9 worshipers at the historic Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina. The shooter had posted photos online of himself posing with a Confederate flag in front of Confederate landmarks. The statement sparked a broader discussion of whether gift shops should sell any Confederate memorabilia. To find out how the gift shop at the New American Civil War Museum navigates the politics of these issues, Melissa went to the gift shop and spoke with Stephanie Arduini, Director of Education and Programming at the museum.
So what's really interesting about gift shops and museums is that they are a tool for extending a visitor's experience with us. So we do think a lot about not only the business aspect of what can people buy, what are they looking for, how much are they willing to spend, but also how the products that we have in that shop relate to how we're telling our stories, that either represent the stories that we're telling in our exhibits and our programs, or help to extend that learning experience. So one thing that speaks to me that's very different but representative of our new institution is a shirt that we're standing right next to with a picture of Frederick Douglass on it. But instead of just being a picture of Frederick Douglass, it comes in a layered, stylized set of colors that looks very contemporary with the way that it's designed. And that's something that I am really excited about as a young adult because I would buy this and wear it. It looks cool. It looks hip. It also has a picture of a person whose stories people might not be as familiar with, but we definitely wanted to make sure we're well represented in the new institution.
Tell me a little bit about the Confederate imagery that will or will not be visible at the gift shop.
We stopped carrying the Army of Tennessee Confederate battle flag shortly after the events related to Charleston and Charlottesville. Over that year, we pulled it pretty quickly and stopped selling it in the shop and on our website. We still carry some flags related to specific units, but that traditional battle flag that's often seen tied to people who use it as a symbol of white supremacy, we've had long institutional conversations about what that means and balancing our ability to tell the story of the Confederacy, because you can't tell the story of the Civil War without the Confederacy, with also that idea of feeling like people should be able to honor their ancestors if that's what they want to, but we don't want the things that we're selling to be misappropriated as symbols of hate. So for the large flag of the Army of Tennessee battle flag, we pulled that pretty quickly.
That's the one that people traditionally, like when I say the Confederate flag in 2019, it's the Army of Tennessee?
Yeah, so the one with the red field and the blue cross or X on that you see often associated with, you know, the rally at in Charlottesville. We also use that moment to think about where else is that flag on our products? How could this be misappropriated for something hateful? And have thought very carefully about that, especially when it comes to items that are cheap, that kids buy on souvenir field trips, where they're not really thinking about the full ramifications of what they purchase. They're just really excited to have $5 or $10 from mom to spend in a gift shop somewhere on a field trip. So we pulled small items that they might have had those battle flags on them and instead tried to find some other products that kids would find interesting and useful and still fit that amount that they could take with them on the field trip so they could have that souvenir to take home, but wouldn't risk having a really messy history attached to that.
So what kind of products did you have to pull in addition to just the flag?
We pulled some small souvenir items like keychains, shot glasses, even small items of jewelry that had a Confederate battle flag on it, and that felt that lacked the context and nuance that we want to convey to people when they come and visit our sites. So if something had a Confederate battle flag on it, but it was also contextualized with phrases about the Civil War and an American flag or cannons and things like that, that is harder to misappropriate. But for something that might have been a necklace or a bracelet that had a charm on it, or just a keychain of that same kind of Army of Tennessee battle flag on it, we pulled those because that was just it was too risky for us. We'd rather have something that somebody could have a more nuanced conversation or representation with.
So can you give me an example? Is there an item here that kind of displays both in that way that you're talking about?
That's a good question. Let's go look. So we're standing in front of a wall of shelves with coffee mugs and shot glasses. And there's a coffee mug here that looks like something you would expect to find at a Civil War gift shop. And it's got a Confederate soldier on a horse holding a Confederate battle flag and a U.S. soldier next to a cannon with the U.S. flag. And it says the Civil War in Virginia. It's got the flag. It's contextualized by being with soldiers on a battlefield. It's going to be harder for this to be something that you have on a desk and feel like, this guy might have more nefarious intent or hateful intent. This is something that says history, the Civil War, and so we were okay with that.
And that's on some shot glasses, too. And there's mugs with Abraham Lincoln. I'm assuming at the Museum of the Confederacy gift shop, would I have been able to buy a mug with Jefferson Davis on it?
We had some that had Jefferson Davis's face on it here and there. But honestly, most people, when they were buying a person, an individual from the representing the Confederacy, the person people most buy is Robert E. Lee, probably followed by Stonewall Jackson. But you could find Jefferson Davis on some things, but that's not what most people bought.
And when you were making these decisions and kind of talking about these things, was it very much with the understanding that you wanted the message of the museum to carry through in the gift shop?
Yes, it's absolutely true. We wanted to make sure that folks could explore this newer, different interpretation of the Civil War and then have something to take home with them.
Tell me a little bit about how you guys have tried to use even the purchase of what flag someone's going to buy as an opportunity to learn more about the history.
We have one of the largest collections of Civil War flags in the country, and we know a lot of really rich stories that go with those and the diversity of flags that are out there, especially when it came to individual units' flags and those personal touches that they put on. And we were excited to bring some of those flags to the public for sale. What we find really interesting is that sometimes we've had people come in and they say, my ancestor fought for the Confederacy, for example, and they'd like, I want to buy a flag to honor my ancestor. And our staff have been trained to ask questions about, well, great, who was your ancestor? Which unit did he fight in? And start to narrow it down. So instead of coming for just a Confederate battle flag, having a more nuanced conversation about the history itself and often connecting our visitors to a more historically accurate flag that also could be less offensive to some people who might see that as a symbol of oppression.
That's Stephanie Arduini with producer Melissa Gismondi at the American Civil War Museum's gift shop in Richmond, Virginia.
So, Ed, Joanne, you all have the benefit of working on some of the most contentious fields in American history. And I got to ask you, from your vantage point as, you know, basically people living in the 21st century, why are people still debating the Civil War so much?
Well, one point, and it's a minor one, but I think it's a worthwhile one, is, you know, as historians, I think any time that we're confronting the past, there's a component of it that feels real and vibrant that we have to reckon with. But I think in a larger way for the public, you have the sort of ancient-seeming wars like the Revolution and the War of 1812, which I think to people are very, very far away. And then you have what probably seem to many people like far more recent wars that seem modern, even World War I, but certainly World War II, that people have some way of reckoning with. The Civil War sits at a kind of middle point that is the past and yet is grounded in so many issues that are fundamentally still being reckoned with in the present that I think it's a tangled subject for people to deal with.
Yeah, it's precisely because of that tangle, that contentiousness, that I felt drawn to it like a moth to a flame. I resisted it for a long time because the Civil War is associated with sort of kitsch and also with a kind of, you know, vibrant buffdom that seems sometimes to repel scholarly understanding. But I came to believe that if we're going to understand the United States, we had to sort of walk into the teeth of this and try to see if we could figure it out for ourselves in ways that we could explain to other people. That's the big challenge. You know, often I point out that there's been a book a week written about the Civil War since the Civil War.
Oh, my gosh.
Over 54,000 books.
Wow.
I got some reading to do. My goodness.
Well, and so that's why I devoted part of my life to writing one more. That seemed like such a savvy thing to do. But
right.
How can it be that we can know so much and understand so little? For me, that's been the interesting challenge about thinking about the Civil War for the last couple of decades. It seems that everybody has an opinion about it, but those opinions don't really seem to align with evidence or with what other people think. So it's the place where the rubber really hits the road, I think, in historic understanding of this nation.
And Ed, I mean, the debate of those 54,000 volumes, I'm sure, has some bearing on military history. But the big questions, I'm sure, are not about whether or not, say, Robert E. Lee should have tried to take an uphill position over 2 days at Gettysburg, right? what seems to be maybe the big arching debate, that, as far as you can see it?
You know, what's discouraging is that the issues of debate today are the same as they've been for generation after generation, which is, what caused the Civil War? And the most recent polls I've seen say that states' rights is what caused the Civil War. That is sort of blameless, that people were fighting for what they thought was right, and they were fighting for their rights. But then people say, well, it was states' rights, but then below that, it was also what people call economics. And this somehow got encoded in our thinking in the early 20th century, and refuses to go away, which is that the Civil War was a conflict between an industrial North and an agrarian South.
I
hear this every time I go out and speak. People just sort of say, well, that's all it really was, right? And it's like, what does agrarian mean?
Right.
It means if you're producing the single most valuable commodity in the world with perpetual bondage, I guess that's agrarian. It doesn't really sound like, you know, a family farm, which is the way that it often comes out. And the North is not really industrial this time. And most of the soldiers fighting each other in the Civil War were farmers on both sides of this. And then the question is, why in the world would an industrial nation dependent upon its agrarian half go to war to destroy it? So there's so many evasions and elisions and just sort of willful refusal to look at the evidence, because people simply don't want to acknowledge that slavery was this serpent at the heart of the nation. They'd like to find something that they imagine lets everybody off the hook.
And it makes it so stark and in a literal kind of a way, bloodless, right? Oh, it's a political conflict. Oh, no, it's an economic conflict. No. It's a human conflict, and it's about humanity on so many different levels. And those other sort of cold-blooded ways of looking at it really remove the essence of the conflict itself.
Yeah. You know, it strikes me, it's like a museum exhibit where they've roped off all the dangerous parts of the exhibit, right? No, don't go in there. Don't go into the slavery room because that's just too scary to think about. But, you know, I've wondered why it can be that, and this is not simply divided Northerners and Southerners disagreeing. There's not really much difference in this 40% of people who think it's the state's rights cause between the North and the South. Westerners are pretty certain that it's slavery, but Northerners and Southerners today, and young people believe it as much as older people. So it's not that we're making progress and explaining to people how this is. And I've tried to figure this out. And one thing that occurs to me is that people who are cynical about the North from looking at it today find it hard to imagine that there was ever a time when there was enough moral purpose in the United States to go to war to end slavery.
Oh, that's interesting.
Of course, they're right in the, right. that sense, right? And so, Joanne, I'd be curious, you know, when you're out on the hustings and, you know, you're talking about a book about the coming of the Civil War, how do you avoid going into these cul-de-sacs of explanation where there doesn't seem to be any way out of them?
Well, I mean, speaking as an early national historian who sort of got sucked into the Civil War vortex, you know, a lot of what I'm talking about is the deeper roots of that later period. So a lot of what I'm talking about is, you know, I mean, it really does go back to the founding. It really does go back to the writing into the Constitution of slavery and the way in which the nation had to reckon with that and the many reasons why in the 1830s that becomes more of an issue. So it isn't, you know, I think the Revolution and the Civil War, speaking as someone who's written about the Revolution, people see them, I think, often as these little isolated bubble moments.
Right, right.
And of course, their meaning is wrapped up in the very fact that they aren't those kinds of moments. And so I think for me, in talking about the Civil War, I'm always looking back deeper and deeper into the roots of where that comes from. And as a political historian, I'm interested in seeing how that gets sort of institutionalized. How does it become so difficult to dig up those roots?
And that's the tricky thing. Those roots are deep and real, and yet people on the very cusp of the war didn't believe that it could happen.
Mm-hmm.
So you have this kind of unpredictable events leading to the very concrete series of sort of coincidences and events that bring on the war at the same time that we know that the origins lie deep in American past. And so the trick is not to have it be all sort of industrial and agrarian. Those roots are there. On the other hand, not to be, well, you know, if he hadn't tried to resupply Fort Sumter, there wouldn't have been a Civil War, this sort of thing that I hear all the time. So to your question, Nathan, you know, as a historical problem, it really does combine sort of the intrinsic challenges of our discipline in a really concrete and unavoidable way. I guess I have a question for you. Looking at it from the imperial distance of the 20th and 21st centuries, you know, what does it seem to matter to you as you try to wrestle with the problems of your own period? What does it matter that we get right about the Civil War?
So I think there are extraordinarily powerful, iconic objects and images and themes that come out of the 19th century. I mean, as a 20th century person, you know, a specialist in that century, you're almost in a way beholden to, you know, deferring to the 19th century people as like the real U.S. historians, right? And by extension, the landscape of like memory around the 19th century is almost just too powerful to ignore and not have a certain kind of deference to. And what I mean by that is, you know, when I was, you know, coming up as a, you know, student in like middle school and high school, right? I mean, watching, say, the Ken Burns documentary on the Civil War, I mean, that was an aesthetically beautiful rendering of the past, regardless of what you might think about its historical content or the narration or the music, right? That there was something about that particular image of the past that was so romantic that I remember like plagiarizing lines from love letters to like my girlfriend at the time to like try to make it seem like I was especially poetic. No, it's terrible. It's absolutely terrible. But combine that with, you know, the power of monuments around the country. Combine that with the kind of, you know, lure of objects like, say, a saber behind the glass, or even say, you know, the Confederate battle flag in an image of massive resistors, you know, pushing back against school desegregation in the South. Regardless of the politics, the image itself is aesthetically powerful. And so as a 20th century person, I feel like part of my burden or challenge or unique obligation, frankly, is being able to wrestle with that afterlife of the Civil War and figure out to what extent there are, you know, fictions or facts kind of mired in the way that we're supposed to frame the events that are unfolding in the Civil War shadow.
And the, you know, the emotion and the other ways in which contemporary meanings get invested in that event. I mean, speaking as a woman, the Civil War was not on my radar screen in any way. It felt to me like a male thing, even before I was a historian. It was a place where guys talked about battles. It was a place, you know, it was a male thing. I don't think I had any perception that it was more than soldiers fighting and men talking about soldiers fighting, you know. So it didn't even, as a younger person, make it onto my sort of my radar of my understanding of American history. It was just the violent middle part that I somehow, you know, didn't feel like I was a part of.
Well, you know, I shouldn't admit this, but growing up as a white Southerner, I couldn't have cared less about the Civil War. You know, partly because we were raised on TV shows and movies about World War II. And so your Ken Burns, Nathan, was in many ways my battlefield, my World War II show. So, and then I go to graduate school in the wake of Vietnam, in which, Joanne, what you're talking about is that not only was it gendered, but it was also generationed. You know, no, we don't really talk about that military history stuff. I rejected it for a long time, but it's the very thing that Nathan's talking about, just recognizing the gravitational pull it exerts on everything else that happened before and after, really, that made me decide that you had to go face it. Now, you talked about the artifacts, Nathan. I think that's one reason the museum is an especially volatile, dangerous, and important place to have these things. Mm. If you read surveys, Americans say, and this kind of hurts our feelings a little bit, that they trust museums more than any other institutions to explain the past. And it's something about the reality of the artifact. You can't argue. Yep.
Right.
Those are those spurs.
Right.
There they were.
Right.
And so, you know, as Christy and our friends have, you know, crafted the American Civil War Museum, and they do have the largest collection of Civil War artifacts in private hands in the world coming from the Museum of the Confederacy. So we have the things like, you know, Lee's tent, you know, things that are very palpable. How do you orchestrate those to tell a story that is both compelling because of its concrete manifestations, but also has some of the gravitas, you know, that's not just the stuff on the battlefield, not just one more sword, but how do you make it tell a story that swept up the entire nation?
And the thing about artifacts, too, is depending on the artifact, they can have such a palpable power that just as you're suggesting, Ed, you don't always need words for that story to be told. So, you know, for example, I was just working on something and we were reckoning with how to talk about slavery in early America and actually in the Caribbean, so in the late 18th century. And we decided that we would get shackles to put. One of the first things you'll confront would be these shackles, adult shackles and child shackles. And there was a debate about how to present them, and one person was talking about possibly what kind of label or what kind of words could explain them. And we ultimately decided there would be no words because there's nothing more powerful than walking in and being standing in front of that, particularly these little shackles for a child. Right. You don't need words to tell that story. That's going to smack you in the face when you see it. But there's such a power. I mean, this is part of what, for me, has always been the fun about working with museums. There's such a power in things that sometimes can grab you at a level that is almost beyond words.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was interesting, the struggles we had going over all the labels for this museum and knowing we could have no more than 150 words to describe anything and realizing the power of every single word to try to get it right. At the same time, recognizing that the average amount of time that someone spends in front of a museum exhibit is 20 seconds.
Right.
And so how do you have this, you know, visceral power, and yet it has to be sort of orchestrated into an emotional journey. This museum, the American Civil War Museum, is very consciously laid out to strike different emotions at different times, and recognizing that you basically can't feel that strongest emotion all the time. You know, and how do you look at the exhibit about the treatment of the wounded, and then about the moment of emancipation, and about the tactics on the battlefield? How do you weave those together in a way that makes sense? So I'm glad we had museum professionals who have a lot better idea of how to do this than just somebody who deals with words knows.
That's all for us today. But please keep the conversation going online. Let us know what you thought of the episode or ask us your questions about history. We're at backstoryradio.org or send an email to backstory@virginia.edu. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Backstory Radio. Special thanks this week to the Johns Hopkins Studios in Baltimore.
Backstory is produced at Virginia Humanities. Major support is provided by an anonymous donor, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Executive Vice President and Provost at the University of Virginia, and the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation. Additional support is provided by the Tomato Fund, cultivating fresh ideas in the arts, the humanities, and the environment. This episode was also produced with support from the Debbie K. Kellogg Foundation, helping Virginia Humanities and Backstory change the narrative of race and representation.
Brian Ballo is Professor of History at the University of Virginia. Ed Ayers is Professor of the Humanities and President Emeritus of the University of Richmond. Joanne Freeman is Professor of History and American Studies at Yale University. Nathan Connolly is the Herbert Baxter Adams Associate Professor of History at the Johns Hopkins University. Backstory was created by Andrew Windham for Virginia Humanities.